coming up on Broadway Radios. This week on Broadway, we chat with Kerry O'Malley. We also talk about First Date, Soul Doctor, Gay Camp, and Harbor at 59 East 59. So please stay tuned.
Oh, you're the other half of the First Date. Oh, he's already here.
He is. How is he? Because my sister said he may in fact be the man of my dreams.
She did? Are you and your sister close?
She's kind of indie and pretty hot. She's the one like all the things that I am not.
What is the point of imagining me if you're not going to listen to a friggin' word I say?
I'm silencing my inner critic.
Tell me about it.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, August 18th, 2013. My name is James Marino. In the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Michael Portantier is a theater reviewist and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many other places on the internet. Peter Felicia is a journalist and a historian with a number of books, Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks being his most recent. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. With us this morning, we have a special guest coming to us directly from the Boston area, Kerry O'Malley.
Hi.
And we know Kerry from a lot of things on Broadway, dating back to Cyrano. I don't think I remember that you were in Cyrano.
I was in it for a brief time, yes.
And then translations, Annie Get Your Gun, Into the Woods, Billy Elliot, Irving Berlin's White Christmas, and On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. Mm-hmm. Kerry, thank you for joining us on a Sunday morning.
My pleasure.
And you are up in Boston doing Kiss Me, Kate at, where is it?
It is a co-production between the Landmarks Orchestra and the Commonwealth Shakespeare Company, and it's at the Hat Shell on the Esplanade, where the Boston Pops do the July 4th celebration. So outside, we hope to have about 10,000 people, and it's pretty exciting.
Awesome.
And I hope to be one of them.
Yay! Mm.
Michael mentioned last week he's going to go up and see it, and I said, fantastic. Oh, you know, we should get Kerry on. And it is a one-night-only thing, isn't it?
One night only, so if we screw up, you know, we can't fix it.
Fix it in post. Is somebody going to record it for you guys and broadcast it on PBS?
Oh, God, no. I hope we would have more rehearsal if they did that. We have like 4 days of rehearsal, just throwing it up there and just jumping in. So I think they'll do an archival video, but not for airing.
Do you know the score?
I mean, I do now.
But you didn't beforehand.
I did. I mean, only to listen to. I didn't. I had never done it before.
Mm-hmm.
And neither had Mark, actually.
Uh-huh.
So Mark Kudish, did we say Mark is the co-star there?
We did not, I don't think. So Mark Kudish is going to be an absolutely stellar Fred Petruchio.
Excellent. Don't ask Mark any open-ended questions. That's my question.
So that out by now.
Had you worked with Mark before?
Yes, we have done. I was trying to think last night where we first met, but we've known each other almost 20 years, I think. I think we first worked together in a reading of Auntie Mame that the Roundabout did that Rob Marshall directed, and it was a benefit for the Roundabout. I think that's where we first met. And we did workshops of the revised Unsinkable Molly Brown together. And, of course, he filled in for Harry Connick in the On a Clear Day workshop that we did at the Vineyard. And we've worked together quite a bit.
So, and you worked together again, I think that the rumor was last night. Is that true?
Oh, yes. So we sang the national anthem at Fenway Park for the Red Sox-Yankees game.
My God.
A joint national anthem? How do you do that? Did anybody videotape it?
I'm sure. I know my parents did. Someone
get that up
have.
On YouTube.
Yeah, I'll try to post it soon if it's any good. I mean, it felt good at the time, you know. So, so I sang the first few phrases, then he sang the second few phrases, then we sang together in unison, and then we went to harmony, and it was a great build, and it was very thrilling, and we got a big ovation. And
who arranged it for you?
We just did it. We came into rehearsal an hour early, and and the, our music director said, well, what note do you want to start on? And of course, it's hard because of our ranges. Yeah. Picking the right key is tricky. So then Mark said, well, what if I do this? And I said, well, I'm happy to stay on melody. So you do whatever you want.
Was it a cappella?
It was, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So. Are you a baseball fan at all? Do you have
feelings? I am as big a baseball fan as there exists in the world. I think it's fair to say that I am obsessed.
All right, for whom do you root?
For the Red Sox.
Do you really? Are you from the Boston area?
My parents are from Boston, and I'm from Nashua, New Hampshire.
I see.
Yeah.
So, and it is not just a, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that Carrie is not just a baseball fan, and
no.
Carrie is a Boston fan.
I am indeed.
You know,
I'm not,
you know, based on her Twitter feed and Facebook and things like that, there's very little that the Patriots could do or the Bruins could do or that, who are those guys that play basketball?
The Celtics.
Yeah, the Celtics. You know, her wardrobe is seasonal, but it's not weather seasonal. It's sports seasonal.
Team seasonal.
Yes. They won, right?
The Red Sox won, yes.
Yeah, right,
I feel like we brought them the luck.
And Carrie is not, you know, she's not a Fairweather fan. She's a big Boston fan, but she, you know, Carrie, you had lived in New York for a long time.
Yeah,
and you've probably gone to more Yankee games than any other Yankee fan that I know.
I know. Well, you know, I love baseball. I'll go watch baseball anywhere. I'll go to minor league games. I'll go to little league games. I'll go anywhere they're playing baseball. And I bring my scorebook and I keep score. And I.
Ooh, wow.
So in other words, you're saying you'll even go watch the Yankees.
I will even go watch the Yankees. I prefer to watch them when they're playing the Red Sox. But I have been known to go to, I think, Yankees Royals, Yankees, you know, even. I just like to watch baseball.
Do you know the movie Fever Pitch?
Oh, do I know it? It's about me.
Well, yes, I would think this would make a good musical, and I can see you doing that part.
Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah, you should commission it immediately, really. Somebody
right?
should do it for you.
I heard someone was doing Bull Durham. Oh. I thought,
uh-huh,
why?
Right, that's right.
Same as someone not doing it with me.
You know, we've chatted here on the podcast a few times before about Field of Dreams. And,
that is so good.
And the fact that, you know, when it comes on, I'm not crying because, you know, something got in my eye. That's
oh, that old line.
But the... But certainly Field of Dreams, they attempted to turn into a musical a number of years back. But maybe somebody get Jason Robert Brown on the phone. We'll see.
Right.
Get this going.
Back to Kiss Me, Kate, just to clarify. So other than you and Mark, is it correct that the other people are locals for the most part?
Everybody's from Boston, or one of our guys is from the Trinity Rep Company in Providence. So, yes, locals, many of whom have worked for Commonwealth Shakespeare before, and Commonwealth does fantastic Shakespeare in the Park on the Boston Common, and so they have a terrific company. So this is a really exciting venture for them because it's the first time they get to do a musical, and to do it at the Hat Shell, it's pretty exciting.
And it's going to be a full orchestra. Is it like a semi-professional orchestra?
The Landmarks Orchestra is like the one of the other major orchestras in Boston. You have the Pops and you have the Symphony Orchestra and then the Landmarks. They actually have a lot of the same guys. Quite a few of the orchestra members from White Christmas, which we did at the Wang, are in it. So I'm looking forward to seeing those guys. It's a terrific orchestra, and it's 37 pieces, so...
Wow.
It's pretty exciting. Yeah.
Oh, and the all-important question, Carrie, which version of Kiss Me, Kate is it? I'm not even sure if they still license the original.
It is the original. So it's the original in the original keys and
original
arrangements. Yeah. So they did say that when they sent it to us. Hey, by the way, these are not the revival keys and not the... not the revival arrangements, which I think was a surprise to some cast members. But I thought, oh, good Lord, I'm in Patricia Morrison's keys.
Well, that makes it even more exciting because I can't remember. I mean, the last time I saw that version.
I know. And now we've had to make some cuts to it because it has to be over within 2 hours. The rules of the Hat Shell are we have to be out of there by a certain time. So it is slightly cut down. I mean, it's not the full show because we don't have, you know, Mm-hmm. It's a concert, but sure. With the scenes. I mean, we're doing the scenes, but believe me, Mark and I are doing the scenes.
You know, Carrie, Patricia Morrison was our guest on the podcast a few weeks ago.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
She lives right around the corner from my voice teacher in L.A.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So it's exciting.
You've met her.
I haven't met her yet, but my voice teacher talks about her all the time, and she signed her Kiss Me, Kate score, and it's pretty neat.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
So tell us, what else is happening other than Kiss Me? After Kiss Me, Kate's over, what's next on your agenda?
So I'm doing a new series for A&E. It's a new drama. It's called Those Who Kill, a very light comic title. it stars Chloe Sevigny and James Darcy, and we shoot in Pittsburgh. It's dark. It's going to be one of these dark cable shows about a team of people. Well, in the pilot, anyway, we're on the hunt for a serial killer. I don't know if that is where... If we'll be regularly searching for those kind of people, but Chloe's a detective and James Darcy's a profiler, and I play Chloe's best friend, who's also the forensic pathologist. So I get the dead bodies and the jargon and so it's not so much a procedural like a CSI. It's more about what this kind of work does to the people who do it. So we have really high hopes for it. It's the lead writer is Glenn Morgan from The X-Files, and I've seen the pilot, and it was really, really scary and really terrific, very compelling. So I'm really excited to work on it.
Are you doing a lot of research, like watching Dexter and stuff?
You know, I haven't been watching Dexter, but my fiance is a police and medical technical advisor for TV. He used to be a police officer, so he has me watching autopsies and we watch Dr. G, Medical Examiner, and he's got me looking at crime scene photos and all that. I mean, it's like I have a built-in research department at home. So,
wow. Carl is such the romantic. It's awesome.
We have dates and watch autopsies. Yes, I know. It's pretty exciting.
Awesome. And so you're shooting in Pittsburgh?
In Pittsburgh, yeah.
And living in L.A. and doing productions in Boston and New York. And so your schedule's full.
I'm a bit of a jet setter. And I just came back from the O'Neill. I was there for the cabaret conference. So.
Oh, yeah.
Wait, am I thinking of Ragtime?
Did you? I did Ragtime out at Sacramento, but that was a while back.
Oh, I'm thinking of something else. I thought there was a Ragtime up at Lincoln Center, but maybe I was thinking of something else.
Not with me.
Not with you.
Hello.
So what else is, does being in an A&E series kind of preclude you from, doing any long-term gigs, or do you try to pop in concerts here and there, or how does that work?
Well, I basically try to say yes to everything, I'll be in Pittsburgh until December, and then we won't air, I think, until February or March, and then we won't know if we get a pickup for the second season until we know how we did in the first season. So the long-term future is tough to know, but I know that unless we get a second season, I'm free until probably, next summer. So
you shoot until December and air in February, so you can go out and do pilot season again in LA.
Well, I can't do a series regular on another show until I'm released.
Oh.
So that would be because I'm a series regular. If I were recurring, I could, yes. And I hope to get back and forth on Shameless, which I do recur on. So they start up in September. And if I can fly back and forth for a few episodes of that, I hope to do so.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
So tell us about some fun things from Billy Elliot. I mean,
that was magical. That was a really wonderful experience. It's one of the shows that I was in that I watched most of from the wings every night. I loved it that much. I loved watching the dancers. I loved the Stephen Hanna as the older Billy was just so glorious to watch every night, and I loved watching Solidarity, and I loved the grandma's number. I just thought the choreography was so thrilling and such wonderful storytelling. And I was there for a very short time. I was filling in for Leah Hawking, who was on a leave. And it was, I've made some wonderful friends from that show, even being there such a short time. So that was a terrific experience.
And the White Christmas, you did it on Broadway. Did you do it out when it was on when it was in the other cities?
Yeah. So I started in. The first production was San Francisco, and then the second year they went to three cities. They did San Francisco, L.A., and Boston. And I did the Boston company. And then the next year they did St. Paul and I want to say Detroit. I think I might be wrong about that, but I did
so.
St. Paul. And then the next year we went back to Boston, and then the year after that we did Broadway, and the year after that I did the national tour. So I did it quite a bit. I absolutely love it.
Fond memories of Karen Morrow?
Oh God, she is such a treasure. Watching her sing Let Me Sing and I'm Happy every night was like getting a masterclass, and she sings so beautifully from her heart, from her soul. I just thanked my lucky stars every single night. I thought, I get to really watch her live up close every night. I mean, and she's the kindest, most generous, most sweet, funny, wonderful, warm presence. She's great to have in the rehearsal room. And then she opens her mouth in that voice, which I have adored for years. I mean, I had a ball and Boys from Syracuse. I mean, just on and on and on. I love her. I can't say enough nice things about her.
All right. Now, there aren't that many people who know I had a ball, so I'm impressed. Growing up in Nashua, New Hampshire, were you interested in musical theater from an early age?
Well, my dad loves musicals, and we always listen to, this is going to sound so silly, but we listened to like musical comedy mixtapes on our trips to my grandparents' house. And we also listened to a lot of Gilbert and Sullivan. So I grew up, my dad loves Fiorello, so Little Tin Box was one of the faves, and 1776 was a big fave. And so that's where I first learned them. And then his sister, my aunt, is also an actress, Regina O'Malley. And she is a glorious soprano, and so we grew up going to see her in shows. And my dad's a barbershopper, so I've been going to barbershop shows my whole life. And
what a great story. This is wonderful.
Yeah.
It should happen in every home.
Right?
I just think that something's in the O'Malley blood because your brother, Mike O'Malley.
I know. He's pretty great, isn't he?
Why don't you tell everybody about Mike a little bit?
So Mike was a couple of years ahead of me. He came out of UNH, and then he did a Meisner program in New York. And then he started out, he was always an actor, but his first big gigs were doing some game shows for Nickelodeon. He did Guts and Get the Picture, and then steadily started working in sitcoms, Life with Roger for the WB, and then Yes, Dear. He had a couple pilots of his own shows that were based around him, and then he did Yes, Dear for, I think, 5 seasons. And then his sort of big, huge break into the national consciousness, I think, would be Glee. He's the dad. He's Kurt Hummel's dad, Bert Hummel, on Glee. And that role has been, I think, very culturally significant for a lot of people, because it's a representation of a dad who loves his gay son and supports him. And I think it's kind of the dad a lot of gay kids out there in America wish they had. So it's nice to see that character exists and exists on such a popular show. So he got an Emmy nomination for that role, and it really made a big difference in his career. And then he spent a terrific season as one of the villains on Justified this year. I don't know if any of you saw that, but it's one of my favorite shows. And he has a new series this year for NBC called Welcome to the Family. So we'll both be on series regulars on TV this season. Hopefully not in the same time slot.
Your parents must be very embarrassed about their kids' lack of success.
I know, you know, they really just, they are so proud of us, and they're so proud of my sister Marianne and my brother Liam. I mean, they're very lucky, and they've gotten pretty spoiled about things like going to Red Sox games and having great seats. So
Mike has thrown out a first pitch.
Mike has a couple of times, yes, and he hosts the picnic in the park for the Red Sox, which is a big charitable thing they do, and he does a lot of emceeing for a lot of the players, both for the Sox and the Patriots, and so he's very well connected and very generous. And he's a season ticket holder for the Sox, so I have gotten to go to quite a few games thanks to him.
Well, let's stop talking about everybody else and get back to you, Carrie. Thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning. You have rehearsal today?
Oh, I do, yeah. And so we're rehearsing like noon to 9:30.
All right. Well, yeah. Wake, you know, give a call over to Kudish. Make sure he's up.
I know. Yeah. Get up.
Thank you so much. We will catch up with you soon and let us know when exciting things happen. All righty.
I'm so glad to talk to you. Thank you for asking.
Thanks. Have a good day.
Absolutely.
Okay. Right. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Hi.
Get out of this date as quickly as possible. Just
but that's just a first impression. I could be totally wrong. It's only a first impression. And though the impression is strong.
What are we supposed to talk about now?
What do you mean?
Oh, you know, on your other first dates, after you've destroyed their spirits and questioned your overall attraction to them, what do you typically talk about next? The weather?
So, last week, Peter talked about First Date on Broadway and the musical, and Michael got a chance to see it, and I saw it. So, Michael, tell me about what you thought about First Date.
I enjoyed it. Much more than I expected. I don't know why I had, you know, I guess we always have expectations for one reason or another. For the most part, I thought it was very, very funny and delightful. It had its share of humor that was maybe a little silly and puerile and obvious. But to me, that was much far outweighed by just really cute, funny bits, funny little observations about first dating. Perhaps, you know, it was the material was fresher to me. I should say, again, it's not only a first date that we see in the show, it's a blind date. You know, maybe for those of us who haven't been on any or on few of those, maybe it's even a fresher perspective on what goes on. Obviously, a blind date is rife with possibilities for humor. Also, I guess, rife with possibilities for disappointment. But I actually, Peter and I were talking last night. We saw a show together, and I think we agreed. The lyrics... the music for this show is the least worthy element, I would say. It's not bad music, but it's eminently forgettable. I don't have any hooks in my head at all. It just kind of came and went, and serviceable might be another good word for it, but really nothing exceptional, nothing special. Music and lyrics for the show are by Alan Zachary and Michael Weiner or Wiener. I'm not sure how he pronounces that. The lyrics, I would say, were considerably better than the music. Again, some of them were, you know, were not that swift, but a lot of them really were, and the audience was responding to them. Although I will say, I had a problem with the sound amplification in several places. It seemed especially when more than one person was singing at once. I sometimes had difficulty understanding what they were singing. And also, unfortunately, there's a running joke of the fact that the main female, she has her gay BFF assigned to call her during the date as her bailout, you know, to give her an opportunity to bail out if she wants to say something like, oh, you know, I've got to go to the hospital, my dog died or whatever, you know. But you know, although those numbers were really well done, by Christopher Cusick, other than the phrase, this is your bailout, I could hardly understand anything he was singing. And I think that's unfortunate. I'm seeing a lot of shows lately where I think that more attention to the sound quality could be warranted. So that's just a note to them for whatever that's worth. The book, I think, by Austin Winsberg is really quite good overall. Very cute and funny, and you know, it seemed very real to me. It didn't seem overtly sitcom-y or comic bookish. And best of all, on the hierarchy of this show is the performers. Krista Rodriguez as the main female, and most especially Zachary Levi, who is just so incredibly at ease and charming and on stage and so funny. I mean, you could just feel the audience adoring every minute of his performance, and really so comfortable for someone with, I guess, you know, limited certainly a stage experience. So that was, he was quite a revelation. I will use that word. Peter?
Yeah.
Where are we going to interject?
Well, I was going to interject that maybe Zachary Levi doesn't have Broadway credits, but he's been doing theater since the age of six. You know, he has been performed at community theaters and regional theaters and things like that. He
knows his way around the stage.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I'm sorry, my mistake. Well, yeah, I meant, but he certainly knew to Broadway in New York.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Sure, absolutely. I thought that the show, I saw the show Wednesday night, I think it was. Michael, when did you see it?
That night.
Was it Wednesday night? Yeah. So, I saw the show Wednesday night, and I loved it. I thought it had something that is always a good thing for audiences, is that it seems like everybody around me related to some aspect of it or some part of it, or mm-hmm. said, I've been through that before.
Yep.
And just one thing on top of the other, and some, you know, everything was not for everybody, but it was enough for me that I really enjoyed it. I loved the whole Jewish number, the Jewish Catholic fight that they had in there, that that he was Jewish and she was not, and it was very well done, and the very clever use of costuming and set changes, and the way they made things appear and disappear and dissolve before your eyes was really, it was so well done. And it was a very strong ensemble cast.
Yes.
You know, as Peter mentioned last week, that everybody in the cast was just really on their game. And it makes it for a seamless evening. It's done without an intermission. I felt like it was, it probably could have been one or two songs shorter. Mm-hmm. But I don't know which songs I would have cut.
Right.
You know, because
right.
I went back and looked, and I says, oh, it felt like it was just a little long. And maybe it was because I'm so expecting an intermission, but there was no intermission. So,
well, as James will attest, the biggest laugh, or certainly one of the biggest laughs, and I don't think this is a spoiler because it's not what they do, it's how they do it. It finally comes time to, you know, for the guy and the girl to decide if they're going to actually stay and have dinner, you know, because they've been, they met at the bar and they're talking and they're like, you know, is this worth it? Are we going to bail? Are we going to, yeah. So they decide to have dinner and they sit down, and then there's like this interior monologue that each of them has as to whether they're going to order what they want or what they think they should order in order to make a certain impression on the other person. And so she really wants a burger, but she feels like she should order a salad.
Yeah.
And he really wants a chopped salad, but when he says he's going to do that, his best friend, played by Bryce Rhinus, like comes out of the ether and says, fuck you, what are you doing? Are you out of your mind? and so so he winds up ordering the salad, and they both order the opposite of what they want. And then the food comes, and then at some point it's like, hey, do you want to try some of this? You know, can I have some of that?
So it's, I came through this experience really enjoying myself, and then I walked out and I thought to myself, is this going to be a viable, from a business standpoint, Broadway show, and I'm not sure about that. I sort of feel like it could have been a good off-Broadway show. What do you guys think? Are they going to be able to pull in the audiences, you know, at, you know, over $100 a ticket that are going to come see something like this? Or is, what do you think?
Well, I don't see why not. I mean, we keep being told that the off-Broadway musical model is pretty much broken. I guess there are maybe, there's evidence on both sides of that. I don't see why this couldn't be, a success on Broadway. I wonder if maybe they'd, I'm not sure if that they opened at the best time.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, no, they have a long way to go before.
I don't know. Something else occurs to me here, though. I was speaking to Frank Wildhorn about Jekyll and Hyde during the period where it knew it was closing. And he said, you know, my plan for this show was always to open after the Tony Awards because I knew we weren't going to get anything. And as a result, at least if you open afterwards, then nobody has to worry if you're good or bad on that score because you just weren't eligible. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that's applicable here, though I do think Zachary Levi would get a nomination. I do think it's entirely possible that this show wouldn't have got too many under the circumstances. So the idea of opening at this time at least absolves them from the responsibility of getting Tony nominations. So then that's another way to look at it.
I think that's a great point, Peter.
No, that is a great point. I mean, as I say, you know, there's you could look at it both ways. On the other hand, maybe there isn't as much attention on shows in the middle of August when people are in vacation mode. But on the other hand, there are so far fewer shows opening that maybe that balances it. So you could go back and forth, really.
So, but I do think that this show is going to have a huge afterlife. In regional theaters and possibly a national tour. I think this can play everywhere. It's a universal theme that I think many people will enjoy and easy enough to put up for smaller theater companies. They don't have to do something major here. So it's I really enjoyed it, and I encourage people to go out and see it because
I do too.
It was very if you can hear the lyrics, I didn't have as much of a problem hearing the lyrics as Michael did, but it's some very, very clever things going on, and I'm looking for the next pieces from these writers.
Yes.
So, tangential, unrelated to First Date, I just wanted to say that flipping through the playbill of First Date and all the playbills in the last couple of years, maybe last two or three years, I see that most of the advertising in this playbill seems to be house advertising. And I wonder if playbill is, we talked last week about the Boston Globe and the New York Times and the effect of print. I wonder if playbill is under those pressures as well, because you flip through the playbill and playbill is focusing on their getting people to their website, to playbillvault.com, to playbilledu.com, all the different things. So I wonder if the print version of Playbill is in jeopardy as well.
The print version of Playbill in jeopardy. I never thought.
There have been those who have said that we are going to get virtual playbills pretty soon, that we're simply going to turn on our iPhone and we're going to get the information there, and that's all there's going to be to it. We'll see what happens. But that is a belief that many people have. I'm not saying this comes from Phil Bursch or anything like that.
No, of course not.
Nothing like that. All I'm saying is that it may very well be the wave of the future.
Yeah, these playbills are a very expensive proposition. And if we go back into the 90s, our playbills were much, much thicker, full of advertising than they are today.
Sure. Let me give a plug for Playbill Vault. I don't know if...
Playbill Vault's great.
If our listeners know this, but I mean, really, if you want to see the important pages in the Playbill, meaning the title page, the characters, the musical numbers, and the bios, go to Playbill Vault, type in whatever show you want that played Broadway, and I dare say you're going to find those first 5, 6, 7, 11 pages there. It's pretty remarkable. And you can really learn a lot from going to it. So my hat's off to the people over there, I mean, for doing that, because who would have expected that we would have had every playbill available to us that made it to Broadway. So
yeah, good for them. You know, Playbill is a company that's sitting on a ton of information that is very interesting and valuable.
Sure.
And I'm not sure if we talked about it on the show here or, excuse me, offline, was that Playbill has launched a number of websites in the past year that are really amazing. Playbilledu.com mm-hmm. is a place in which people can research how they can study theater and go to college and which undergraduate and graduate programs are great. I mean, it's a wealth of information that they've got there. And at Playbill Vault that we talked about, they've launched all these different websites that are really maximizing the information that they have. And as maybe their print business ebbs and their other business will flow. Mm-hmm. So I'll take it from there. So other things that are interesting to us is that Michael and Peter got a chance to see Soul Doctor on Broadway. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
An excellent show for the Jewish Community Center, no question about it. That's what it really seems like. It's about a rabbi who needs to sing. So therefore, we're very much into the jazz singer territory, where everybody is railing against him and the family. What a disgrace it is that he should want to spend his time doing this when he could be devoting his life to God. And it's funny, not to bring in a non-kosher meat here, but it reminded me of Tenderloin, the musical that was from 1960, because everybody pointed out that in Tenderloin, which was about a preacher who came to New York and tried to get rid of all the vice and corruption, that we seem to side with the women because they were having such a good time and everybody's having such a good time in the brothels while this guy was trying to shut them down, and we didn't really like him for that. So much of it does deal with the aspect of, oh, you can't do this, you're disgracing the family, you're killing your father, all that stuff that you get very tired of it very quickly, because we don't see why it's such a terrible thing that this guy should make music, since there's music inside of him. It's based on a true story, a person I had never heard of. And I have to say that everybody I've talked to has never heard of him either. But there's no question, if you do the research, you find out he was around during the 60s and really wanted his career, and had a great influence on Nina Simone, and she on him, that they really helped each other tremendously. And for a while there, we were even considering getting together romantically, which brings up another problem in the story, too, believe me. Music is affable. The performances are very good. Eric Anderson playing Shlomo, the gentleman in question here, excellent. Jacqueline Antimerarian playing the mother, really terrific. Amber Iman as Nina Simone, phenomenal. So they're all very good. And I have to say, I was very, very, very impressed by the direction. Daniel S. Wise did it, and he really did a very good job of making it as slick as it could be. So this is not a great show. It's not a disaster by any means. It's perfectly competent, but it doesn't seem like a Broadway show to me. I think it's going to be a tough sell for a lot of people because, again, the conflict seems to be a case closed for so many of us. Everybody has different feelings about religion and the value of it and what have you. So there may be people who really side on the side of the people who want him to give up this stupid show business thing and get back to what's real, you know, but that's another story entirely. So anyway, I don't think it's going to be around very long, but the people, if you're going to write this type of show, I don't think it's going to turn out much better than what these guys did. So my hat is off to Daniel Wise, who also wrote the book. And I also thought the new lyrics by David Schechter were pretty good. And the music, of course, is by Shlomo. His last name is Karl Bark. And some of his lyrics are used, too. I can see where people would be intrigued enough to start working on a musical of this guy. Hey, they got it up, you know, so my hat's off to them for doing that much. I don't expect it to be around very long.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
Wow.
I don't think my hat is off. I think my shoe is off. My shoe is off to throw it at them.
I see.
Oh, I thought you, I didn't realize that. You,
okay.
Yeah. No, I think it's just terrible. It's kind of appalling. I mean, I think the opposite, Peter, I think that actually, that other people, whom I wish had been involved, could have done a much better version of this story, because I think the story overall is very interesting. The friend that I went with, I mean, you know, we agreed on, you know, how terrible the book was and how bad the lyrics were and how, you know, how obviously sledgehammery the acting and the directing were, but yet he said, well, you know, I wasn't bored. And I said, well, no, I wasn't bored either, because it really is interesting. And we've seen variations of this story in the past, like the jazz singer leaps to mind. I mean, that's somewhat similar story. I just thought that the actual dialogue was so from hunger, if I can use that phrase, that it, you know, I was like gasping at various points. There's jokes about the Jewish guy being nailed to the cross in a church. The scene of Shlomo's father's funeral was so offensive that I almost left the theater at one point. It's just, these people should not be, have not come anywhere near Broadway. I don't like to see work of this quality on Broadway. It's very frightening, I think. It's just, I guess, come down to whoever can get the money together in whatever way gets to have a show on Broadway, and it should not be the case. I also, I very much liked the woman who played Nina Simone. And where's her name here? There she is, right at the top. Amber Iman. Eric Anderson as Shlomo, I liked his stage persona and his acting, but I guess I'm in the minority. I really did not like his singing so much. He had, a wobble that was very difficult to listen to sometimes when he was singing loudly in his higher register. So that was another minus for me. By the way, I don't know if you're all aware of part of the history of this show was that it was it played in Florida in January 2012, and it was supposed to be Gary Morris as Shlomo, but then he left for whatever reason, and Mike Burstyn wound up doing the role. So isn't that interesting?
I wonder why he didn't come to town with it. That
I don't know. I don't know. But also, I don't know if either of you know this, and someone mentioned to me last night in conversation, and I looked it up, and sure enough, one thing the musical does not deal with was that Shlomo was, let's see, a ruling was made in 1959 by Rabbi Moshe Feinstein banning Shlomo Carlebach's music after it was determined he was sexually assaulting several teenage girls and adult women.
Mm.
That certainly has no place in this show. You won't find it there. So I guess they didn't want to get into that. Not much else to say on my end. I really enjoyed the music. The music itself, I really enjoyed. It's that kind of music that it's kind of hard not to enjoy it. It's very soulful and very bouncy, you know, it kind of makes you want to start clapping. And
well, it doesn't make me want to start clapping, I'll tell you.
Well,
and there's no question that they want you to. And you're encouraged to clap along, if not assaulted into it. It's one of my pet peeves. You know, I don't like when they want me to clap along and have that type of what they consider to be a good time. So, yes, this show is very guilty of that. Go on.
Well, no, I agree with you, because
way, you know,
I think we agree, we share that, Peter. I don't like the audience participating thing, even to the extent of clapping. But all I meant is that it's very it's the kind of music that might make you want to do that if you want to do that. And you know, I mean, it was used to you know, buy this Shlomo to bring people together and to you know, to create that kind of feeling. So I guess for me it was effective, but I, you know, I just don't. For what it's worth, I would say the reviews were overall were quite hideous, and it will be interesting to see how long it lasts. Even though it does have a certain built-in audience, I think we would all say.
Mm-hmm. Well, is it smart to open right before the Jewish holidays then? If you know, if you're going to lose your audience for the first week of September or so, a couple of
good point,
weeks
because,
there.
This was the most yarmulke-wearing audience I've seen in a long time. So no question they got their target audience in there. But that's a very good point. It's going to suffer a bit during that period of time.
All right. Well, Michael is going to have to leave us for right now. So, Michael, you have a great day, and we'll speak to you next week. So, Peter, you got a chance to see Gay Camp. What did you think about it? Do I remember correctly? Did you see Gay Camp before in a festival?
No, never have. The title is slightly misleading, because it really is about a camp where gay kids go, not that they want to, but they go to be converted into heterosexuals. Their parents are sending them. One boy thought he was going to go see Newsies on Broadway. Another boy thought he was going to Disney World. I forget what the third boy thought he was going, but actually, as it turns out, their parents are sending them there to, quote unquote, cure them. So, so that's what it's really about. And of course, as a very wise Mark Waldrop lyric goes in, When Pigs Fly, you cannot make a maple from an oak, from an acorn in an oak tree. You know, you just cannot. And eventually, of course, the show does come to that conclusion. Very funny much of the time, very scattershot, blackout sketches more than anything else. Kids fall in love, kids try not to fall in love. Sometimes the kids go along with the conversion therapy, sometimes they don't. But done with a good deal of humor and yet an occasional lapse of taste. The audience groaned quite a bit in one sequence involving abortion. But nevertheless, a very, very fun-filled evening most of the time. And my hat is off to Philip Mutz, who not only co-wrote it, but also appears in it and is hilarious as the camp counselor, June, which I think has something to do with Gypsy, by the way. But very much involved because her father has promised her that if she does a good job this summer, he is going to turn the camp over to her. So she has a lot at stake here, and she is going to make sure that these guys toe the line and become heterosexual. So about an hour, 15 minutes maybe, at the duplex, you're at tables. They'll come into the audience and talk to you, believe me. So maybe you want to sit back if you don't like that to happen to you. Frenetic, crazy, wild. Wonderfully done, though, by these guys who I really can't say enough because they play so many roles and there's only three of them. But at one point I realized, gee, who is this guy? I mean, I couldn't even recognize him as one of the three guys. He looks so different during another scene. So So I thought that was terrific, and I like that very much. And I'm really hoping that this show continues at the duplex. And, you know, so you are going to be challenged at points with some of the beliefs you have about abortion and other matters which are in dubious taste. But that happens about once every 10 minutes. And I don't think it should discourage you from going otherwise to Gay Camp.
So I was looking at the Gay Camp website here. They have shows scheduled through September 14th at the Duplex, and we'll see what happens. Also, I went back and looked, And it was actually Michael that saw Gay Camp at the,
I see.
At the Fringe. He saw it at the Fringe last year's 2012 Fringe. And so I'll will link that into the show notes, and we'll when Michael gets back next week, we will chat about it and see what he thought.
Yeah,
of Gay Camp.
Yeah. I didn't know he was going to be there, but as it turned out, the seat next to him was empty, so I just sat next to him. And I can say that certainly, if laughter means anything, he certainly had a good time. So I think he'll have nice things to say about it too.
Well, yeah, I'm sure if he saw it at the Fringe and went back to see it at the Duplex, I'm sure, liked it as well. So, Peter, you also saw Harper at 59 East 59. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, a play by Chad Begelin, whom we know more as a lyricist for The Wedding Singer and Elf. And here he is writing a full-length play that's really, really good. It's about a gay couple. Who made a decision a long time ago that they were not having children, though frankly, Kevin is more anti-kid than Ted is. But still, kids are not going to be part of the equation at all. Well, Ted has a sister named Donna who gives him a phone call. And at one point, he actually says, "Oh, are you in jail?" And we immediately know that this lady has been troubled. She's been very strange. And in fact, she's virtually homeless. She and her daughter, Lottie, are traveling around the country in a van. And that's the closest they have to a home. And they're hoping that Ted is going to be nice to them and take them in for a while. And Ted is reluctant, and Kevin is more reluctant, but okay, you can stay a few days. Well, it doesn't take long before that few days is a few months. But what happens after that is really intriguing, and I've been really struggling to think how I can make this point without giving away the ending, but I will say that in an age where we talk a lot about adoption, and there's no question that babies get adopted much faster than teenagers do. And many kids have to give up hope that they're going to be adopted as the years go on. This play might give those kids hope that there's that because they're fully grown, well, almost fully grown, but given the fact that they are up there, that they have personalities, that your personality can win over people, that you come across as a neat kid. And God knows Lottie comes across as a neat kid. The story goes in a lot of convoluted directions, but Chad Begelin is always in control of it. It's wonderfully written. The characters are terrifically developed, and we're very lucky to have a very good cast doing it. I was very impressed by Erin Cummings as Darna, because this is a woman who's totally irresponsible and is totally at home with it. She sees no problem the way she's living her life. I mean, she's an adult. She has the right to do whatever she wants, and that's all there is to it. Alexis Molnar, who plays Lottie, her daughter, of course, becomes the parent. She's the one who really has to step up to the plate when there are times when the mother just doesn't know how to make decisions or makes wrong decisions. And she's terribly frustrated with the mother, and she's counting the days like a kid till Christmas, till 18 comes along, when she can get away from this woman. Please get her away from me. Paul Anthony Stewart is Kevin, the one who is very much into his career and does not want children. And Randy Harrison is Ted, the one who thought that, well, maybe having a little baby would kind of be cute, you know, and that'd be fun, and maybe we should do that. And Donna's arrival with Lottie does bring these issues to the surface, so that's what happens there. Randy Harrison is excellent, too. The whole cast is wonderfully, wonderfully directed by Mark Lamos. And you'd expect no less, because he's certainly one of our best directors today. So Harbor really held my interest. I was tired that night, but suddenly I wasn't, because this play made me wide awake. And I really recommend it very, very highly, and I hope it has an afterlife.
Michael also saw this, and we reviewed it back a few weeks ago on the August 5th podcast. So 2 weeks ago.
Around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we reviewed it 2 weeks ago on August 5th, and Michael said much of the same thing.
Oh, good.
So I will link to that if folks want to go back and listen to Michael's point of view on that. And we'll take it from there. So I'm so excited to see Chad Beglin doing more and more work.
Yeah, yeah.
It's always a good thing.
Sure.
Peter, in the news last week, before we wrap up, I wanted to chat about the passing of Shirley Herz. We heard about that after we had recorded last week, so we didn't get it in last week. But I just wanted to get your thoughts on Shirley.
It's so interesting that I do a column every week for Masterworks Broadway on original cast albums, and I always plan this week to do one on La Cage aux Folles, because it's the 30th anniversary this week of La Cage aux Folles. And this was a show that Shirley handled. And she certainly was one of the great press agents. She did spectacular work. She was wonderful with the press. I'm really going to miss her smile, and I mean that. She really had a terrific smile. And so always greeted people from the press with a warmth that you don't find with every press agent. I mean, she really seemed to be glad to have you there and be part of the party. So I really like that quite a bit about her. And I'm sorry that she won't be part of the 30th anniversary celebration of La Cage aux Folles, because Lord knows, yes, sure, the show was wonderful. Yeah, but she got all the articles out there early in advance. She made it happen in Boston. I mean, she made that such an event in Boston, believe me. Do you know that when the original cast album came out in Boston, there were actually stickers on the original cast album that said, "Thank you, Boston." Because it had been so good to La Cage aux Folles. So, I mean, and I know that was Shirley's idea. So a good example of why she was terrific. And certainly the people she mentored over the years, Sam Rudy especially, who has become a wonderful press agent of his own, certainly has a lot to look to Shirley to thank her for. So it's really too bad that she went so quickly and went... So we'll miss her. We really will. I did like that smile.
Yeah, and she really she worked on Broadway for. And the New York Times said that she'd worked on Broadway for 65 years.
65 years, yeah.
65 years. So I mean, never had a different thing. And her smile, as you said, yes, it lit up a room. And it's amazing that you could, if you didn't know, you would think that she was. Starring in a show and not press repping a show, you think that she would be in front of the footlights. So
yes, I agree with that. I think that might have even been a goal early on that she was going to be. Because I remember a tribute to her about 20 years ago that Liz Smith emceed. I still remember the line when they built the first stage ever. Shirley was there holding the hammer. So I do remember that. But I think I recall there was some time when she was planning to be an actress, but anyway, she found her niche, and that's what's really good that happened.
The New York Times left a parting message that I think that everybody who knew Shirley would appreciate. It said, one thing that she was always secretive about was her age. And the worst part of all this, Mr. Brown said of her passing, is that she would be furious that everybody finally knew how old she is.
I'm not saying that that isn't how she felt. That may very well be the case, but really, does it matter when you're dead? I mean,
that
you lived a long time is a wonderful thing.
Absolutely.
I mean, certainly Damon Intrabartolo would have been very happy to live to 87. Here is the composer of Bear.
Yeah.
Did part of the book too. And I don't quite know what happened. It hasn't been made public yet exactly what happened. But he died at 39. And Bear was a good show. So, I mean, it's really sad to think that somebody didn't live half as long as Shirley Herz. So it's really too bad that somebody with such potential and somebody who we even relied on to give us some more good music is not with us anymore. And I don't know what happened there.
Yeah, no, I it's another very sad passing this week, and life cut too short.
Mm.
We can't pass by this week's mention of an injury at Spider-Man, where Daniel Curry was injured when his leg got caught in a trap on the stage. Peter, what do you think about what's happening here?
Well, there's no question that management has made it seem as if it was Mr. Curry's mistake, which it may very well have been. But it's too bad that this is back in the news, because Spider-Man had been going along reasonably smoothly since that terrible start that it had, when things were certainly not going smoothly. So what's really sad about this story is that the injury doesn't seem to be superficial. And we'll have to wait and see exactly how extensive it is. But this was no, oh, we better get him to the hospital just in case. This was, we better get him to the hospital. So we're wishing for good things to happen to Mr. Curry.
Yeah, this is... This seems to be a very serious injury, and we'll have to wait to hear how he is. And there seems to be a groundswell on social media that people are asking for the show to close. And I wonder if that's merited at this point with so many injuries, or if this is something else that it's just that we hear more about it because of heightened media and social media, and everybody's on the internet. I seem to recall, but I might be incorrect here, maybe you could help me, that during Starlight Express, that a number of people kept on getting hurt in Starlight Express, but you didn't have such a hyper chamber of news at that point. So maybe it passed by. What do you think?
Well, those weren't injuries of the same scope.
Yeah.
For that matter, if we're going to talk about injuries, what about cats, where people were throwing out their back all the time, that they actually had a chiropractor or somebody like a chiropractor on staff, that you could show up at any time to go to the chiropractor's office and get straightened out. So because people were not meant to walk the way cats walk. So the Starlight Express injuries were more like cats than the Spider-Man ones were, as I recall. But yes, indeed, the world has changed since Starlight Express, which is suddenly a long time ago, you know, a quarter century ago. And as a result, we do hear about things a little quicker and a little more extensively. So as a result, we may have heard more back then, and maybe the injuries were bad, but these seem to be worse.
Yeah, that's true. All right, so I'm going to wrap it up. Do you have anything else you want to throw in for this week?
I want to say that I was at the Els, I think that's how it's pronounced, New York yesterday at North Rockwood High School to see a production of Les Mis, the school edition. And I am telling you, these kids were amazing. And, you know, it was so wonderful. It never really occurred to me until I got there. Needless to say, Les Mis depends on a lot more on boys than it does on girls if you're doing the school edition. And they really got the boys out there to do this show. It's funny. My buddy Bert Silverberg often says, you know, you try to get boys on stage and they resist, but if you tell them they can be a shark or a jet, then they're interested. Well, I think it's true of Les Mis too. I think, you know, Les Mis's reputation and all that, and the fact that it deals with the revolution and teach and rebel, whatever it is, they got the boys out there. The boy playing Valjean, phenomenal. The boy playing Javert, probably even better. Amazing work by these kids. And of course, you know, when the time came for Fantine to sing, or Cosette to sing, or Eponine to sing, you got the cream of the crop then too, because you have no problem finding three girls who could do these parts, and the voices were magnificent. So Justin Macedo, I know, is behind this, and he has done phenomenal work in directing, because it isn't easy to do Les Mis. I will admit that I was a little surprised at some of the language and adult situations, shall we say, that it still seemed to be in this school edition. He told me yesterday that he just did what was on the page, and I'm going to be speaking to him in a while. I'm going to ask him that question again and see if he still stands by what he said yesterday. But me referring to a member of a man's body, certainly using vulgarisms for fecal matter and one's gluteus maximus, I wouldn't expect in the school edition of Les Mis, but this is not my decision. And I guess the world has changed. And, you know, the parents certainly didn't seem up in arms at any of this. I guess they figure they're doing Les Mis. That's all there is to it. And but boy, did they do it well.
That's great to hear, because that can be a train wreck.
yeah. You know, I mean, I go to the Junior Theater Festival in Atlanta every year, and I talk to directors, and I say, what are you doing? And so many of them say, well, I'd love to do Les Mis, but I don't think I can. This might indicate that you could, because the kids really rose to the occasion.
That's great. All right. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the frontpageofbroadwayradio.com, and there's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time you have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded for you so that you don't miss anything. You can also listen to us on the Stitcher app. That's an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and it'll stream to you automatically. Or listen to us on Broadway World Radio, which plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, and me is at BroadwayRadio.com. That way, if you have a comment or you want to touch base with us, you have email, voicemail, Twitter, Facebook, all different ways to reach us. As well as on that show page there, there's lots of different ways to see the things that we've talked about today. If you do have a moment, please stop by iTunes and give us a review, because positive reviews on iTunes will help more people find our show and also give us some feedback on how we're doing. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.